come up on a tight wire.
I'm sitting here in Studio B, also known as the arena, and I'm sitting across from my good friend, Daniel Chacon.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend, Benjamin Alida Sainz.
And welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
Today, we have a very, very special show. We have a writer named Carlene Bauer, who just came out with a beautiful novel inspired by the relationship between Flannery O'Connor
and Robert Lowell.
And it's a fantastic book, so we're really excited to talk to her. And also, on Poetic License, we have probably one of the most incredible writers I know, Benjamin Alida Sainz.
Yes, I'm going to share some thoughts with you on...
He's going to diss education.
I'm going to share some thoughts with you on the contemporary state of American education.
And you know, when we first conceived of this show and this segment, particularly Poetic License, we had thought about calling it Writer's Rant. So a writer can rant about issues and give the strong opinions. And it sounds like you're going to have some strong opinions.
This may be a rant.
Well, I can't wait to hear it. If you are going to be in Boston on the week of March 6th through March 10th, make sure you come by the AWP conference. What is AWP,
then? AWP stands for the Associated Writers Programs, and it's a consortium of all the creative writing programs in the country. It is a huge, huge event. It started off small, maybe 500 people used to go, and now we're up to 5,000 or 6,000
yeah,
people.
It's been over 10,000 the last two conferences in Chicago, over 10,000. And you know the amazing thing about it? You have these hotels, and they're full of people, writers everywhere. And the fact is, out of all those 10,000 people, 5,000 of them at least have multiple books.
I mean, really, you can't flick a cigarette butt without hitting a writer.
And because there's writers, there's a lot of cigarette butts to flick. And then there's also this book fair that they have in the hotel. And this is one of the probably the biggest creative writing book fair in the world. Well, at least in the United States. And fiction is represented, poetry, literary journals, and Words on a Wire. We're going to have a table there, and we're going to record, since there's going to be 5,000 writers with books, we're going to talk to 5,000 writers.
We're going to become roving reporters, so stay tuned for that show in the future.
And also, if you are in Boston on Wednesday, March 6th at 7 p.m., I'm going to be doing a reading along with Lee Herrick, who has been on our show, Tim Z. Hernandez, and that's going to be at the Democracy Center in Cambridge. It's at 45 Mount Auburn Street. And that will be at 7 p.m.
And I'm going to be there as a groupie.
Anyway, it's going to be fun. AWP is going to be a lot of fun.
Stay tuned for our interview with
Carlene Bauer, author of the new novel Francis and Bernard. Carlene Bauer is author of Not That Kind of Girl, a best-selling memoir, and her new book, Bernard and Francis, a novel. She is a graduate from Johns Hopkins University and has been published in The Village Voice, Salon, Elle, The New York Times Magazine, and many others. She lives in Brooklyn. Carlene Bauer, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Well, thank you for having me.
And congratulations on this beautiful book, Francis and Bernard.
Thank you.
I'd like to say that I read it in one sitting, but I ran out of time on the first sitting, so I actually read it in two or three. It felt so effortless, just sinking into this world, and it was very beautiful. Now, it's inspired on a relationship between Flannery O'Connor, of course, who is one of my favorite writers, and Robert Lowell. Can you tell us how this book came about?
Yes. Well, there's a book called The Life You Save May Be Your Own by Paul Ely, which is about four American writers who were also Catholics. And in this book, he talks about Flannery O'Connor. And I read this maybe about 12 or so years ago. Mm-hmm. In the book, he talks about how Flannery O'Connor and Robert Lowell met at Yaddo, and I think 1957. Mm-hmm. And in the book, he suggests, I think, that maybe there might have been a little infatuation on O'Connor's part, or that maybe there was something a little more than friendship. Mm-hmm. But no one knows for sure. And so when I read that, I thought, that's astounding, because I'd read a lot about literary history, I like to think, and I thought no one had ever brought this up. It's a minor sort of point, I guess, in literary history, but it struck me because they seem so different, so different. She, you know, she was very devout, he, you know, very, very Southern, sort of I love her, but I will say provincial, maybe, and right. proudly so. And he, you know, being a Boston Brahmin, sort of gone to Harvard, very, very sure of himself, very effusive, sort of in the grand manner. And I thought, but what if they had fallen in love? Like, that would have been a crazy... And so it took many years for me. After I'd finished my first book, I said, well, what am I going to do now? And I somehow, I forget how to sort of, you know, wandered back to that idea. What if they had fallen in love? And since I wow. needed another project, I thought, what if I made people like them fall in love? Because I am still a 13-year-old girl. And and so I started writing a story where two people... Because historical fiction, while it's not ever been my bag, I guess, like, right. it's not... I would rather read the history. That's just me. I know many, many people love it, but I wanted to try to write something that did not feel, that was not so slavishly dependent on the historical record.
You know, so you changed their names.
Yes.
Well, let me ask you a question, though. Wasn't it difficult, or was it difficult, to create characters based on Flannery O'Connor and Robert Lowell rather than just fabricate on your own characters?
No. Although, I will be honest, and sometimes I think, like, after I finished, I thought, shouldn't I have just made this about two different people entirely and set it in the present, you know? But but I was taken with the predicament that they found themselves in, Lowell and O'Connor, and no, it didn't seem hard. I'll leave it at that. I felt like I could come in and out of fact and imagination whenever I wanted, and tried to imagine... more often than not, if that makes any sense.
The interesting thing about this book is it's told through letters, the letters yeah. between the two, and every now and then a letter from one of Bernard's friends or
yeah.
from one of Francis's friends.
Uh-huh.
But the characters are so distinct, and, mm-hmm. and Francis is very focused, very intellectual. Mm-hmm. She's an intellectual religious person.
Yes.
She's not really an on fire for the Lord,
no.
Holy Spirit type of person, but incredibly
no.
intellectual. Mm-hmm. The Robert Lowell character, he drinks a lot.
Yeah.
He loves to party. He loves women, especially mm-hmm. attractive women.
Mm-hmm.
And it would seem like it would be such an unbelievable relationship, but you develop it very well and you make it mm-hmm. absolutely believable. Did you find that challenging?
Well, I think what I felt challenged by was I know I've seen a lot of relationships like that,
mm-hmm.
I know that women, this sounds strange, but I know that women often find themselves in friendships. Well, men too. Like, I think we all find ourselves often in friendships where one is more reticent, the other is mm-hmm. more intrepid. And so I think having experienced those kinds of friendships and seeing them sort of work out in different ways, I thought, well, I could draw on that. Like, I knew what it was like to sort of have oil and water in a way, but mm-hmm. still be able to sort of make it believable. I think I had more fun with it, actually, to try to flesh it out. Like, what would it, because I think that's what made me want to write it. Like, how can I make this believable, but also just fun and pleasurable for another reader, if that makes any sense.
I'm curious to know, are you Catholic? Are you interested in, I mean, it's so convincing. Is that part of who you are, your makeup? Are you a religious person?
I was. But still, I was raised evangelical. My first book was about being raised that way. And then I converted because I went to a Catholic college and was taken with the way I'd seen a certain sort of liberal Catholicism practiced, was taken with Catholicism, and then converted when I moved to New York, I guess about 12 years ago now, but no longer practice. But I do feel that if one is raised... And I did believe for a long time. I feel like it, for many people, you never quite let it alone, and it never lets you alone.
So I think that's absolutely true.
Have you had that? Have either of you had that? Were either of you raised Catholic?
I'm a former Catholic priest.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Candid camera. That's not fair. Oh, my God. I am even more deeply honored. Oh, my God. Were you a Jesuit?
No. I was a diocesan priest, but I was trained in... theology at the University of Louvain in Belgium, and I studied there for 4 years.
I went to Loyola College in Baltimore, and they had a long time ago, but they still do have a program in Belgium at Leuven.
Yeah,
that's how we called it.
Yeah, no, they should call it Leuven because it's a radically Dutch town, and I use the French pronunciation, which is wrong.
Which is
so wrong on so many levels.
Oh my God. Oh, wow. I got this pass at a priest. That's so awesome.
Now I feel like I'm being interviewed.
So. I have that tendency. I do a little bit of journalistic writing, and so I have a little bit of that. All right. So
Carlene, let's get back to your book.
Yes, yeah, sorry.
And so let me ask you a question. What was the most pleasurable thing about writing this book for you?
I think it was just letting the two characters enjoy each other and feel things. I know it's a terrible way to put things, but to feel things for each other. And I think that, I know that people may think differently, but I have felt in contemporary fiction, and I can see why there are reasons for this. I can see why, but I have not really felt moved by a lot of contemporary characters. I feel that I have been moved mostly by characters who were written in the 19th century. And I know why.
You sound like Francis.
I do. I know. But I do feel that, I thought, well, why did I try to write a novel that would satisfy me as a reader? Like that I felt like, I think of The House of Mirth, the Edith Wharton novel, where Lily Bart, every choice you make, you go, oh no! Like you just, or even if you watch Downton Abbey, that's sort of like, oh no, what's going to happen? You know, I can't believe she Mary denied Matthew yet again. And I wanted to create two people that readers felt that way about. And even when that may not be like a literary impulse, I felt like that's why we read.
What's your next project?
It is currently a novel. I'm trying to work out what it will be exactly. But I know that I want it to have something to do with music fandom, or I shouldn't, a love of music, particularly rock music. And I know that's not very literary either, but although it is actually kind of, and it's currently proving difficult to wrangle, but I hope I wrangle it.
One of the things I found interesting is that the two characters, both writers, a poet and a fiction writer, as they begin their relationship through letters, decide they're not going to talk about writing. But they end up talking about it anyway.
Yeah.
But one of the things that Bernard says, I thought that what really struck me and made me think of maybe Carlene Bauer is a teacher. Hmm. He says, the most talented students this year think talent absolves them from discipline.
Oh. Well, I have taught a little. But I know people who have taught.
But that concept is true. I mean, Ben and I teach in an MFA program here at the University of Texas El Paso,
and
it does happen a lot. You get these brilliant students who think their brilliance kind of exempts them from having to develop their craft.
That is terrible.
Yeah, but it does happen.
Well, Bernard knew it. How did you know this?
Well, I've taught a little like adjuncting like composition classes, as one does in New York. And the two times I did this, there were two women students I'm thinking of who, one worked hard, but still fell short, but had been sort of convinced by others of her own brilliance, so it was hard to sort of get to her and see how, actually, you might want to do this or that or the other, but she was willing to work. And the other I'm thinking of thought she was brilliant. And because she had been told so. You see, like, the kids who get all A's in their high school classes and there was no sense, I think, with either of them that they needed to change their approach. And I was not there to sort of get them to question their whole way of mode of study. Like, that was not my job. Like, I was only coming in, like, one time a week. Like, and a boy, too, I'm thinking of, like, very, very good. And they knew they were good. And I was a very good student. And I knew I was good, but I also knew that I needed to know some things. You're just not getting that sometimes from the best.
Well, I think,
do you know what I'm talking
about? I know
absolutely
what you're talking about. I can reframe it another way. A sense of humility.
Yes, I'm sorry. Well, that took me a very long time. I think I'm so shocked by that concept that I can't even bring myself to say it out loud. They lack humility.
But it's not something that the culture values or teaches them how to be at all. And I think that if you're going to be any kind of writer at all, you better have a sense of humility or you're not going to be able to write compassionate, compelling characters.
I think that's true.
And maybe it helps that Frances comes from a family that really is not, you know, quite as intellectual and learned as she is. Her family is very, I'm reminded of a Flannery O'Connor, somewhat apocryphal perhaps, quote from her aunt, Flannery O'Connor's aunt, that, you know, the story isn't over until somebody's married or gets killed.
Mm-hmm,
and it seems that the family is constantly misreading or perhaps doesn't understand what Frances is writing. And perhaps that gives her a little bit of humility because she could very well be subject to arrogance, people with her talent and her her focus.
Well, I think, did you read her letters?
I did.
Did you love them?
I did.
I did too. Mm. But you know, in her letters, she comes sometimes across as a little arrogant.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think that arrogance is that she's just so smart.
I know.
And she gets so impatient in the face of stupidity.
I know. And you're not allowed to do that.
Right.
I know.
She kind of reminds me of a monk who is so spiritual, yet they're so impatient sometimes with people who are a little bit less there. And I'm thinking of that one quote where she talks about the Beat Poet. She says, "The Beats are really nothing more than a troop of malevolent Boy Scouts trying to earn badges for cultural arson."
Oh, my God. Did I write that?
No, Frances said it.
I know. Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah. She were channeling her.
Well, I think I had fun having her make these withering pronouncements because I feel like you're not supposed to do that anymore. Like on the internet, people are very mean, but they're not very smart about it.
No, they're not. Yeah.
I want to ask you about Barbizon, or I want you to talk a little bit about Barbizon. Oh. That, for me, it was such a fascinating setting in part of the novel when the Frances character goes into New York and she needs a place to live.
Yeah.
So she lives in this place called Barbizon, which ironically, I suppose, or coincidentally, or maybe even does have a connection to the modeling school, Barbizon.
Oh, yeah.
But it's this place where women stay, single women, and all these women seem to be looking for husbands.
Yeah.
And emphasizing their looks. But there's this one scene where there's this lady with a veil and she's sitting there and she's eating by herself and you can tell she's a little bit older and it's very telling of what might become of a lot of these women. But can you tell us about that setting and where did you come up with that?
Well, I had been very interested in women-only residences for a long time. I think a lot of women can sort of get interested in this idea of like a secular nunnery. And the Barbizon is no longer, like, it exists. It's now a luxury apartment building, as you would expect.
Right, if it's in New York.
Yeah. And Sylvia Plath stayed in the Sylvia Plath. Like,
oh, really?
Elaine Stritch, Candace Bergen. Like, there's a who's who of people who stayed in these. And in the Bell Jar, Plath calls it the Amazon, which I think is very funny. And I had done a little bit of reporting for like an aborted project on these places. So I was taken the same way you were taken, and you could see and if you read pieces about these places, which I did, like there's always, you know, a few older women who have been sort of just, you know, allowed to stay in the building. I mean, the expectation is that you go after you get yourself, you know, on your feet.
Right, but, right. Like you should only be there in your 20s somehow.
Yes. I think these places, there are a few left in New York City, but they're dying out.
You know what it reminded me of? Do you ever watch Mad Men?
Oh, yeah.
The setting of New York, the way you depict it reminded me of that. It's, you know, probably most of these girls that live there, young women, are secretaries, you know, coming into the city for the first time. And
I think there's an episode where Don Draper drops a young woman off at the Barbizon. I forget what series, and I thought, oh, I really love Mad Men.
But I did love that image of the older woman with the veil. It almost reminded me of a Renoir.
Oh, God.
We've been talking to Carlene Bauer, author of Frances and Bernard. It's been really lovely to have you on our show. You're just a delight.
Oh, thank you. Well, the both of you were as well.
This week's Poem of the Week comes to us from Edwin Rolfe. Edwin Rolfe was born Saul Fishman. He was what they called at the time a red diaper baby. His parents were communists. He was raised in an activist family. He became an activist and a poet. He fought in the Abraham Lincoln battalions in the Spanish Civil War. He was a committed poet and a committed activist his whole life, a lifelong communist, and a really elegant and beautiful poet. He wrote a book of poems called First Love and Other Poems. And that book is about Spain and his experiences there in fighting with the Abraham Lincoln battalions in the Spanish Civil War. This poem is entitled First Love. Again, I am summoned to the eternal field, green with the blood still fresh at the roots of flowers, green through the dust-rimmed memory of faces that moved among the trees there for the last time, before the final shock, the glazed eye, the hasty mound. But why are my thoughts in another country? Why do I always return to the sunken road through corroded hills, with the Moorish castle's shadow casting ruins over my shoulder, and the black smock girl approaching, her hands laden with grapes? I am eager to enter it, eager to end it. Perhaps this one will be the last one, and men afterward will study our arms in museums and nod their heads and frown and name the inadequate dates and stumble with infant tongues over the strange place names. But my heart is forever captive of the war that taught me first the meaning of peace and of comradeship. And always I think of my friend who amid the apparition of bombs saw on the Lyric Lake the single perfect swan. That poem was by Edwin Rolfe as he reflects back on his experience in fighting in the Spanish Civil War with the Abraham Lincoln battalions. For this week's Poetic License, I have a few random thoughts about the state of education in America. Mahatma Gandhi was once asked what he thought of Western civilization. "I think it would be a good idea," he quipped. I'd like to move from Gandhi's remark to another topic. Education in America. "I think that would be a good idea." I don't know where we went wrong regarding educating young people in this country, but I do know we have gone wrong. How did we get here? Why can't Johnny and Susanna read? Why can't Diego and Samantha think critically? Why don't we pay teachers well? Why is the study of literature in our high schools relegated to the few nerds and dorks that are somehow uncool? Cool kids don't read. They get tattoos. We have created a culture that puts a greater value on sports than on intellectual endeavors. In our public schools, where is the heart? The heart of our schools? Well, it's the football stadium. It's the basketball gym. It's the soccer field. It certainly isn't the library. Shouldn't the school library be the heart of any school? Why isn't it? Neighboring New Mexico has the highest dropout rate among Hispanics in the country. And though the national graduation rate is at an all-time high at 78%, I don't think we have much to crow about. The graduation rates in our nation's major cities is only 53%. In the suburbs, the graduation rate is 71%. The devil is in the details. This is a huge disparity and an unacceptable one. Those suburbs are overwhelmingly white, and those city kids, they're black and Hispanic. But even if we graduated 99% of the students who entered high school, what exactly are we teaching them? We are teaching them to pass a test. Are we not? By the way, I don't give tests in my classrooms. There are other ways by measuring what students have learned. I make my students write. Diego can't write because we don't make him write. Diego will learn to write when he practices. Practice does make perfect. Or at least practice makes one literate. Texting doesn't count.
students who read learn to write better. They learn how to articulate themselves on the page. They learn to think. They acquire critical thinking skills. They just might need those skills outside the classroom. They might even be able to clearly understand that climate change isn't a matter of opinion and that sexual orientation is not a choice. The problem, as I see it, is that we have created a system that disempowers teachers and empowers politicians to make rules about a field they know nothing about. Teachers should be in charge of their own classrooms. And if we don't trust them to do their jobs, then why did we hire them in the first place? Teachers should be professionals who know their academic disciplines and have the skills to convey their knowledge to their students. But really, education is no longer seen as a necessary public service, if you will. Teachers are no longer seen as necessary public servants, but as employees. Employees, because education has been reduced to a business. And make no mistake about it, the big winners here are the companies that create the test. Now that's a big business. Businessman. That's a word we treasure in this culture. Intellectual. That's a word we can't bear to hear. If we don't turn things around in this country, then we are going to cease to be a world power. Imagine a country filled with an intellectually curious populace. I know. I'm a dreamer. I'm a professor, not an employee. I write books. Well, I write them because I'm an intellectual. An intellectual in an anti-intellectual country. The odds aren't in my favor. But I like being an underdog. This is Benjamin Alida Sainz for Words on a Wire. We'd like to thank our guest, Carlene Bauer.
And we'd also like to thank you, Ben, for not only reading that lovely poem.
Edwin Rolfe, one of my favorite poets.
It was a good poem. Thanks for reading that. And also, thank you for your poetic license and your writer's rant.
It was a real pleasure, I'll tell you that.
Join us next week when our guest is going to be Alberto Rios, whose latest book is called The Dangerous Shirt. It's a collection of poems put out by Copper Canyon Press.
Oh, before I forget, I'd like to remind our listeners that live here in the area to attend a reading by Philip Levine, who will be here on March 12th. He will be reading at the Undergraduate Learning Center here on the campus of the University of Texas at El Paso. The event will be at 5 p.m. I urge you to attend. He's a former poet laureate. He's been on our show. He was a wonderful interview and has a great sense of humor. Put that on your calendars. And again, we'd like to thank you for listening to another edition of Words on a Wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alida Sainz.
And don't forget, the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on the tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on the tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see.